Case number 13-1194, Otis Elevator Company, petitioner versus Secretary of Labor et al. Mr. Yoha for the petitioner, Mr. Gladman for the respondents.
Yeah. Always bad. Okay. Good morning, late morning.
Good morning. It still is. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Stephen Yohei on behalf of Otis Elevator Company. Your Honors, this case is not about a hazard that was created or an employee exposed to a hazard as a result of Otis not exchanging information with Boston store employees. The case is not about exposure of a Boston store employee to a hazard. So no hazard, there's no argument about this in the government. No hazard created, no employee exposed to a hazard. And really the question arises, what are we doing here? From Otis's point of view, they have the question, what is it that OSHA would have had their repairman say to someone, we don't know who, at Boston's store?
Well, as you pointed out, it could have been made part of the contract, although you say it would be another 50 pages.
Well, and this takes us to the question which may occur to you, and which is, why is a company like Otis here on a $300 citation? And that is, and this is explained in the briefs, and it was proved at trial, Otis, as you may well know, is a very large company that does thousands of elevator repairs on equipment of really innumerable variety. Elevators.
And I thought, based on what the argument was before the commission, that Otis was trying to make the point that the commission should rule that this standard simply does not apply except in a limited set of circumstances.
Well,
and the commission rejected that argument.
There's several arguments that Otis was trying to make.
That was one of them.
That's one of them. But even if the standard is deemed applicable, and we have a substantial question with that, as an OSHA lawyer, I go to the heart of this, which is black letter OSHA law, OSHA 101, that for OSHA to prove a violation, it must, among the elements it must prove, is that an employee was exposed, either was exposed or could reasonably be expected to be exposed, mm-hmm. and that a hazard was created. Mm-hmm. And the government doesn't argue with the fact that there was no such, those facts didn't exist here. Their argument
is... I think they say there may not have been actual exposure, but there certainly was a risk of exposure. Had some child dropped their ball and gone running right under that gate when it came down?
Well, it's not quite clear. First of all, the law, as I understand it, is that there must be more than just a possibility of a freak situation developing.
Well, I'm not in a freak situation. Did you have a lockout procedure that addressed locking up the gate so when this chain went back on, you wouldn't have this risk?
There was no lockout required, Your Honor.
Did you have a lockout procedure for blocking up this gate? Otis has all sorts of
lockout procedures, but they weren't applicable to this job.
The record shows that you had a lockout procedure for precisely the risk that occurred here, and that was blocking up the gate so you wouldn't have it come crashing down. Is that accurate?
I think, an unfair characterization of the facts, Your Honor, with all due respect. The repairman testified, and I think the administrative law judge found, that there wasn't that risk here.
Note 2 of the JA345 Note 2, which is in the Commission's decision. Otis's LODO procedures, I don't know if I'm pronouncing LODO correctly, required its mechanic to block the gate mechanically or with a biparting door tool to prevent unexpected gate movement. Otis does not dispute that the mechanic failed to do this.
But, Your Honor, a block is not, as defined in the standard, is not a lockout takeout device. A lockout tagout device, the definition, which is quite specific in the standard.
Why was it in your LODO procedures?
Pardon me? I don't know, frankly.
So it's in your, it's, 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 it may this have, note it, says it was in your LOTO.
it is not unusual for employers to go well beyond what OSHA standards require. But the point before the court is whether it was a lockout, tagout procedure as defined in the standard under which this company was cited. And a lockout, tagout procedure is one that is a positive means to hold an energy-isolated device in a safe position.
But it was in your lockout procedures, and the commission has found that it was Otis's LOTO procedure was to block up the gate mechanically.
The point is that...
So what is your burden to show that they're factually wrong, that that was not a LOTO procedure?
First of all, it's their burden to show that it was.
You're on appeal now. So
pardon me?
You're on appeal now.
That's correct.
We have a commission decision making a finding, so I don't think they have a...
And what I'm suggesting to the court is whether or not it was a lockout procedure or not, the fundamental burden of proof required to prove an OSHA violation was by the government's concession not satisfied here.
No, I don't think... I think you articulated yourself as actual risk or potential for risk, and they say there was potential risk here. That's precisely why you have a lockout procedure.
And the judge who tried the case found precisely to the opposite.
I understand, but the commission doesn't have to defer to
fact
findings made by the ALJ.
That's granted.
But we have to defer to fact findings made by the commission.
You have to defer if there is substantial evidence. Mm-hmm. But there is no substantial evidence. There may be a statement in the decision, but if you read the record, I'm sure you have, there is no evidence of risk
guys,
in this case.
Is this a lockout procedure? Is this in your manual on lists of lockout procedures?
Apparently, it may, in the appropriate circumstance,
right,
be considered, but it is not. The government has not shown you that this is a lockout procedure as it has defined that procedure.
Would it not be stopping the, I think what they called it, the kinetic energy of, or the gravitational energy of the gate crashing?
That may be an energy isolating device, but that's different. That's a different terminology than is defined in the standard. If I may complete this, the definition of a lockout device, and Your Honors, I of course can't testify, but having sat through the rulemaking hearing back in the 80s to listen to the standard being developed, there's a distinction between an energy isolating device and a lockout tagout device. A lockout device has a very specific definition, it's a term of art. And it means a positive hold on an energy isolating device in a safe position. You turn off a circuit. You put a padlock through the hasp to make sure nobody comes along. And that's
Did
another.
Did you tell the commission that locking up the gate was an energy, protection device as opposed to a lockout device?
Yes, I believe that was a position. Well, I didn't try the case, but that is my understanding.
Is that in the record? Is that argument in the record?
I believe it is. I have some insight into it right at this moment, but I believe it is. That was a position I understand at trial counsel. And the point being, let's go to the point of the standard that was cited. Interestingly, Your Honor, OSHA withdrew the citation to Otis for failing to use a lockout tagout procedure. Now, I'm not going to sit here and say I know exactly why that happened, but at the beginning of the ALJ decision, you will find that the party stipulated the citation that OSHA originally issued for failure to use a lockout procedure was withdrawn. That did not go to trial by consent of the government. And so what does that tell you about whether or not there was a lockout procedure? That wasn't the issue that was litigated. The issue litigated was whether it was inappropriate for Otis not to exchange a procedure, not to inform. The standard cited doesn't require the exchange of a written procedure. It says inform. And so who was the repairman supposed to inform? About what? He wasn't going
to... When you're required to inform or exchange procedures, whichever you're using, does OSHA require that you do it at the moment of the event, or can you do it in advance when you sign a contract saying, look, we're your repair people, we're going to be here a lot, here are our procedures?
Well, that, first of all,
is that an option?
It is an option because, and that takes us to another.
Is it is or is not?
It is, and let me explain the significance of that. As a means of covering themselves for not proving exposure or a hazard, OSHA has characterized this in the OSHA world as a specification standard, as opposed to what we call a performance standard. That is to say, OSHA says, we don't have to prove harm, we don't have to prove a risk of harm, you don't have to prove any kind of any harm, because this was a specification standard, and it says whenever. Doesn't matter what the facts are. You've got to do something. Tell somebody something. We don't know. The answer to your question, we don't know. The point is, if OSHA says
we
have
these... Well, what do you do in practice? Do you only... If you're in a situation where the record shows, do you only do it at the moment of the event, or do you do them in advance sometimes?
The answers are innumerable, because every situation is different.
Okay, so you don't have to do it at the moment of the event.
Not necessarily. That's one of the questions. When should the repairman have said something to the Boston store employee?
Well, not the repairman. When should you have said something? When should the company, Otis, have said something to Boston?
There's no point. There's no way to know what the right... They have thousands of procedures.
What's to lead you to think that it wouldn't be sufficient to do it at the time of contracting?
Because you don't know what the facts are. You don't...
Why do you need any facts? If the only... You sign a contract with somebody, and you say you know you're in association with them, you turn it over at that point, and then you're set. You're done.
It's not it. There are thousands of procedures. Which one do you pick? Is it an elevator for an elevator manufactured 20 years ago? Is it an elevator for an elevator manufactured last week? We don't know. That's the point.
Give them all.
Pardon me?
Give them all to them.
All? With all due respect, Your Honor, I think that's an impractical suggestion.
Is that the 55 pages? You talked about 55 pages.
That's my understanding. These procedures are quite extensive, and they can be. And
but is that
no
all?
Doubt.
In other words, if you say all, I mean, if all is eight truckloads, it's one thing. If all is 55 pages, it's another. What do you mean by all?
Well, as I understand the record, it's somewhere in the nature of 50 or 55 pages. But again, It depends.
Why is that impractical?
It's impractical if you multiply it by 70 or 80,000 repairs a year, and it's pointless.
But it's
What's the point of you giving to an employer?
Well, that's a different question, all right?
I'm sorry?
That's a different question.
Which one?
And that's the next
case.
That
it's pointless.
Yes, that you sign a contract and you give Boston Company this 55 pages, they file it away in their file drawer, and nobody looks at it again. But that's not the issue here.
It's not that they would not necessarily know which 55 pages to give. That's my point.
Well, I'm just going by what your brief said.
Well, the point is, if we don't know what is going to be the appropriate procedure until the repairman gets to the store and looks at the elevator. Until then...
Well, suppose it works this way. Suppose the full gamut is 55 pages and not eight truckloads, because that's what the record indicates. If it's 55 pages and you have to turn it over at the time of contracting, then what that does is it imposes an OSHA-enforced obligation on the part of the recipient to communicate that to its employees. You're done at that point as long as your employees act consistently with your own procedures. Then you show up at the scene. There's nothing that has to happen. It's just that you can assume that the party that you're servicing communicated the procedures to their employees. If there's a failure on that part, it's on them.
It makes no sense, Your Honor, to construe this entire scheme as simply a paperwork burden. The point is to protect people.
Yes, and I think that would work. If everybody communicated in the way it should, it would be protected.
That's why the notification, the information, needs to be a function of what the repairman actually finds. It's fine.
No, but that's, you know, the fact that the elevator is 20 years old or 50 years old, you're still supposed to lock it and tag it. All right, and what equipment you use, what screws, what generators and all, that may differ. But we're talking about some basic procedures.
With all due respect, Your Honor, that's not correct. You may or may not necessarily lock and tag it. In this case, the evidence is clear. All of the controls were on top of the elevator car.
Well, but
there was no opportunity for anybody in the... I'm sorry.
If you blocked up the door, that would not have been on the roof. That would have been where the door was, correct?
The door was jammed. It wasn't going anywhere, and it's counterweighted.
Until it did go somewhere,
until he put the chain back on the socket, apparently it moved.
But the point is, and the evidence is very clear about this, that didn't mean it would... It doesn't mean it would precipitously drop. That was not the case here.
I know, but this is interesting that Otis's own employee was injured for failure to have this blocking.
With all due respect, Your Honor,
you say he didn't want to spend another 3 hours when it crashed and he'd have to have a bigger repair, but that's sort of a reasonably efficient employee in how he would proceed.
I don't say it. He said it.
Who?
The repairman. His testimony
is... I know, but you're relying on him.
Yes.
All right? He said he grabbed the chain because he was afraid...
had nothing to do with locking or tagging the mechanism.
I know, but if he'd had the...
But there's nothing to lock or tag. What do you put a lock on?
Did he grab the chain because he thought this door was going to slam down?
No, he grabbed the chain, and the record is crystal clear on this. He grabbed the chain because he was concerned that if the elevator started to move, it would come off the sprocket again. The chain would come apart like on a bicycle chain.
The chain would break.
The chain might break. Not that the door would crash, but the chain might break. And he'd have to fish into this. You can just imagine fishing into this little hole alongside the wheel to try to get it out. And that's when he hurt his hand. It had nothing to do with lockout, tagout. And, of course, we can't evaluate.
Would the chain only break because the gate was falling?
We don't really know why the chain.
I thought he said that's what he was afraid of, that it would fall down and break the chain.
He was afraid that as it started to rotate, not that it would fall down.
That it would move.
It would move and it would come off again.
So it's the movement of the gate.
You can't evaluate whether it was appropriate. The violation occurred before he did the work. We can't look backwards and say, he got hurt that way. Therefore, we know now that the citation is appropriate.
I think this case is a bit odd. I grant you that because there's a mismatch between the violation and the injury that actually happened.
But
the way the commission looked at it was that the injury that we're concerned about at the end of the day is the injury that would have been occasioned had the mechanic put the device under the gate and then had employees happened upon the scene.
He did put the device under the gate. We said earlier the block was in place. He did that. The point is, that's not a lockout.
He apparently didn't do the thing that your own rules required.
Pardon me?
He apparently didn't do the thing that your own rules required.
That's correct. I'm sorry. I misspoke.
Okay.
The point being, though, let's go back and look at what this standard says and how it's going to be implemented in reality for a company like Otis. And then, once again, I pointed it out, the impracticality, again, of not knowing what you're going to find until you actually get and look at the situation. And then, second, this interpretation of this standard, that is to say, we don't have to have harm, we don't have to have exposure, whenever. This is a brand new interpretation. This industry has not seen this interpretation before. I don't believe this OSHA has articulated this interpretation of the standard before. OSHA has never said before that this standard is what they call a specification standard. The standard is replete with references to the fact that this is a so-called performance standard, where it's up to the employer to try to figure out what has happened here. So this is a classic situation where OSHA has used a citation to articulate an interpretation of a standard for the first time. And the Supreme Court said in CF&I Steel, the Martin case, that they can do that, but it bears very heavily on the issue of deference. It's a negative on deference. That is to say, the best way to issue, first of all, issue a standard that's clear. Second, to issue some kind of an interpretation, whether it's through what OSHA calls a compliance directive or a letter of interpretation. But let's not find out when the compliance officer walks in. Today, we now know what the standard means. That's not notice.
All right, why don't we hear from the commission? We'll give you a couple of
Thank you.
Rebuttal.
I did reserve 2 minutes.
I know, but time's moving.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
Please the court. I'm Scott Gladman, Secretary of Labor. This case concerns an elevator company that failed to inform its customer of its lockout tagout procedures before unjamming the customer's elevator. Because this failure potentially
now would it have been a failure if the company had been informed at the time of the contract?
No, it would not have been a failure. But the point is there was no such.
Right, so you don't think, the government doesn't take the position that there has to be an exchange each time there's a repair?
No, I'm sorry. The notification had to take place before the work actually started.
But did it have to take place immediately before on that day, or could it have taken place ex ante?
I think it would depend on the circumstances. If, for instance,
how about the circumstances of this case?
Here, the notification had to take place before the repairer unjammed the elevator.
How far before? Could it have been? Would it have been okay if Otis had sent Boston its procedures months before, at the time of the contract, and just said, "Okay, now it's up to you to figure out what to do with this, but we have an obligation to advise you of our Lotto procedures, and here we're in satisfaction of that."
I think that the elevator company had to inform the Boston Store what specific procedures it was going to use. So as soon as the elevator company could have determined what it had to do, the notice was required.
So
In other words, the
logic is, though, that he'd have to inspect the elevator first, figure out what's wrong, then write up some procedures and give them to the company.
No, he wouldn't have to write up the procedures. The company already had the procedures.
But you said he'd have to wait until he figured out what...
Well, yes. But what I'm saying is once he identified what the problem was...
A jammed elevator.
Yes. He had to inform the store of what the company's elevator company's procedures were.
So I gather Otis had been servicing this company for a while.
Yes.
So presumably it knew the kind of elevators it had, so if, say, 6 months before or periodically it provided the company with notice of its lockout procedures, that would be fine.
As long as those procedures covered the type of work that it was going to do on the occasion of this visit.
Well, I just need to be clear here. I thought the lockout, tagout procedures were fairly basic procedures about what you do when you're going to work on equipment that has the potential for self-activating. We're not talking rocket science here.
That's true, Your Honor.
All right, so you send some procedures to the company. So the company says to its employees, look, when they're repairing this elevator, stay out of the way. You have no role here, and be sure no customers go anywhere near there, and no kids with little balls. So everybody knows what the rules are. But are we talking about something much more complicated?
No, we are not. The main concern here was to make sure that the Boston Store employees did not interfere with or be harmed by this unjamming activity.
Mm-hmm.
Now, because this failure to inform Boston...
Can you respond to their argument that this decision was the first time that the OSHA had ever announced that either there could be presumed risk would be enough, or two, that this was a specification standard they had to comply with specifically?
We don't agree with that at all. In fact, the preamble to the final rule of the standard also presumed the hazard of interference from employee misunderstandings with the activity in question, and also the possibility that the employees who interfered might be harmed. So that was in the preamble to the final rule, and it's also in the compliance directive. So this was not the first time. The point here...
What about that it was a specification rather than a performance standard?
Again, this was clear not only from the wording of the cited provision, which says that whenever an outside employer works on the premises of the host employer, the two employers are required to inform each other of what their lockout tagout procedures are. That specificity is sufficient to tell the employers what they have to do. Now, opposing counsel refers to references in the compliance directive to this standard being a performance standard, but all those references say with regard to this cited provision is that the employers have the option of using either their own lockout tagout procedures or the other employer's lockout tagout procedures or a combination of the two. That in no way negates the specific requirement of informing each other of what their lockout tagout procedures are. Now, furthermore, because...
Can I ask you a question about this? There is this requirement from some of the decisions that the commission decisions that in order to prove a violation that the employees had to have access to the condition that causes the violation. And is your view on that requirement vis-a-vis this case that that requirement doesn't apply because of the nature of this particular violation? In other words, an information exchange violation as to which that requirement doesn't exactly map on? Or is it that, in fact, that requirement does apply, but it was satisfied because there were employees at the work site, even if the employees weren't, we don't have a finding that they were directly next to the elevator, but it's enough that they were at the work site? Or what's your position on that?
The latter position that you described.
Okay.
What we say is that this provision presumed the hazard that Boston store employees could have interfered or have been harmed by the unjamming activity. But we also say that these employees had access to the unjamming activity because they were in the store and they regularly visited the elevator.
So if the store was closed, would you have a different position on that than there's no employees there?
If the store was closed, we would maintain that there was still a violation, but that there was no access. That there was no access to that particular hazard. But the point is, that really isn't enough because it's possible the store could have been reopened at some point, and the employees could have come while the mechanic was still working on the elevator.
But you would at least have to have that.
Yes.
The employee, there has to be some possibility of the employees. In other words, if it's closed, I don't know, if we're somewhere where they take 2 weeks of vacation or 2 weeks on holiday in Europe somewhere, and there's actually no reasonable prospect, you would...
Right. We'd have to show access.
Okay.
I have night watchmen.
What about the night watchmen? Yeah, and if there's any possibility of any employee coming in, yep. That
I'm
would be
sufficient. I'm a little confused that you're saying you have to show actual access. I guess if you're saying as long as there's a person somewhere in the building, then we can presume they would be hurt. How does the presumed risk interact with your requirement that you have to show actual access to the zone of danger?
Well, these are two separate elements. Mm-hmm. What we're saying is that the cited provision presumed the hazard of a potential release of unexpected hazardous energy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, unexpected release.
Mm-hmm.
But in addition to that, we have an access requirement, but that access requirement is not so difficult to meet here because it just requires that there be employees in the store and that they visit the elevator. If it is reasonably likely that they visit the elevator, then access exists. And here there was evidence in the record that employees regularly visited the elevator. And furthermore, there was the mechanic testified that some of the employees in the store didn't even know he was there. So the access requirement was satisfied here.
Anything further?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Counsel, of course, I said I'd give you a couple of minutes.
First, on page 24 of the Secretary's brief, quote, contrary to Otis's contentions, no showing of a hazard or employee exposure to a zone of danger was necessary to establish the violation. To hear counsel now say that, Boston store employees were there all the time, no, that was not what she was shown in the trial.
But on the same page, on footnote 9, instead, as the commission correctly found, the record establishes the Boston store employees were present at the store and had access to the elevator gate.
I thought that was a finding by the commission as well.
They did not have access to the zone of danger, and that was only on top of the elevator car, and that's all that counts under the commission precedent that you made reference to, Your Honor. You have to have access to the zone of danger.
I thought the zone of danger wasn't on top because the idea of what the commission said was if your mechanic had complied with Otis's own procedures, then the issue would be whether an employee of Boston store would come and kick the elevator gate locking device in some way that would cause the gate to come crashing down. So that's not on top of the elevator. That's under the gate.
But the record shows that there was no risk there. That's the point. The record shows that there was no risk there. And the ALJ found that.
No employee actually tried to do it?
No, that there was no risk of the elevator being being moved that way. And the ALJ found that.
Well, there's certainly, there's certainly risk that the gate was going to crash down because it did.
From the ALJ decision, the only zone of danger was the area on the elevator car top, which contained the chain and sprocket.
Right, that might be wrong.
I think the commission said that was wrong.
The commission, with all due respect, I understand the point about the commission having to follow the ALJ, but he tried the case. He heard the end. He credited the witness.
I'm just telling you, that a gate crashed down, correct?
And the gate did
not crash down.
If
my foot had been there when that gate crashed down, I guess my foot would have been injured pretty bad.
But if it had crashed down, but that's not this case.
All right,
also, on the question of performance standard, if I may, first paragraph of this standard says, this is 1910.147A1, scope.
Right, this is in your brief.
Yes.
Yes. Just response to counsel's arguments, please.
You heard Mr. Glavin say Otis wouldn't know what lockout takeoff procedures provide until the repairman identified the situation he had. I thought I was listening to myself when he said that.
That's why I asked him the questions.
Well, I like the answer. Also, lockout takeoff procedures are in fact very complex. The OSHA standard requires not just simply that you lock something out. There are training requirements. There are annual inspection requirements. It's a very complex process.
On the lockout tagout?
Yes, Your Honor. Consider this is not the only kind of facility in which this standard applies. Put yourself in the middle of General Motors.
No, I know. They're volumes.
They can be voluminous.
But the contract with this employer to repair the store's elevators, that's what we're focusing on.
Well, if the ruling in this case is limited to the facts of this case.
No. It's a question of, did your client comply with the requirement to inform the Boston company of the lockdown tagout procedure?
The answer is it did not inform them because there was no lockout tagout required in this case. And you've heard the argument about that, and you've heard parsing the standard. And if you look at the definition of lockout tagout device in the standard, you will, I hope, understand why I'm making a distinction between lockout tagout device and the block that you've been so concerned about. This is indeed a performance standard. The burden of proof question is not trivial. We are all concerned about the possibility of exposure. And by the way, this law, as you know, only applies to employees. That's not to say injuries to children or the public are trivial, but that's not the purpose of this standard. This standard is to keep, laudably, employees of the host employer from becoming enmeshed with the service contract.
Right.
Last point I'll make, and this is in the our brief, OSHA has a separate policy called multi-employer citation policy, which it applies when there's more than one employer on a work site. And it's a decision tree analysis. And OSHA ignored that here. Believe me, from having defended many of these cases, they generally don't ignore it when it's convenient. It requires a determination who created the hazard, who controlled the hazard, who could have abated the hazard, and that sort of thing. And that has to be viewed in context with this case. The important point about it is that policy is explicit, and we cited this in our brief, in that it requires an examination of the facts of each situation. You cannot just generalize about who is responsible. No such analysis was made here. Our position is until this repairman got there, there's no point in informing. And the facts of this case are, we're hearing a lot about Boston, all of a sudden a crowd of Boston store employees. The record is clear. There was hardly anybody in that area. The elevator was clearly marked as out of service. There were a handful of people there when the repairman arrived. The store was not open. There were no members of the public. There were no children. That's not this case.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take the case under advisement.